In this centenary year of the outbreak of the First World War, we are all inundated with information about it, so we think we already know a lot about the war. For example, we think we know it broke out on the 4th of August 1914. But in fact, Great Britain declared war officially on Germany at 7 p.m. on Monday the 3rd of August. It's just that in those days, pre-electronic media, it wasn't published until the following morning. We think that Sir Edward Grey, the Foreign Secretary, said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe, and we shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." But this remark was not mentioned until 1925. Even the name First World War is problematic. In the beginning, most people referred to it simply as the war, assuming it was going to be over by Christmas. For most of the time, the war to end all wars was known as the Great War. If you research the actual term First World War, you'll find on a reputable website, sponsored by the BBC, the statement that the term was first published in 1938 in America. But this is despite the fact that a Lieutenant Colonel Charles Acourt Repington, a lovely name, published a book in 1920 called The First World War. He was the war correspondent of the Daily Telegraph. And he himself referred to the title, used the title as early as September 1918 in Harvard University. So, given that much of what we think we know about the First World War is not entirely accurate, we're here today to discuss issues raised by the research conducted on the impact of the war on Ickworth. And we have with us today Chloe Woodrow, who's the Assistant House Manager at Ickworth and the co-chair of the Ickworth Research Group. We have Peter McGee, who's a volunteer member of the research group and the coordinator of this research stream, and Iris Taylor, a volunteer member of the research group who lived at Ickworth as a very young girl and so has a very personal attachment to the people who lived on the estate. So, Chloe, first of all, can you tell us why it was that you asked the research group to look at the First World War and what were you hoping to find out?
So I think maybe if I just give a bit of context. When we started looking at the Exemplar project, there was a few key things that we wanted to do. So we wanted to pull out the stories about the family and the people, and we really wanted to focus on our collections and how amazing they are. So Jan, our curator, and I sat down and really started to think about those questions, those areas of knowledge where we just felt we didn't have enough information. We weren't able at that point to give visitors a real detailed or a rich story that would be interesting and engaging. So we came up with, a few key topics. There was women of Ickworth, there was the concept of the Grand Tour and how the family collected. And World War One and World War Two kind of came out of that. And I think it came from, actually, when I was contacted earlier last year by the National Inventory of War Memorials. And they were, because we're obviously in this period of remembrance, they were looking at what memorials, dedications we had here at Ickworth. And we actually found one at the local Horringer Church just on the estate. And I think at that point, Peter, that's kind of where we started. So Peter very kindly offered to look into this plaque that was in the church, and it had some really familiar names on it. So there were people who lived here and also worked here and had clearly, obviously, gone off to war. So it was really quite poignant, and it really started me thinking about the impact that the war had not only on Ickworth as an agricultural estate, as a kind of a working place, but also on the families and the people who were living here at the time. And as, it's quite big at the moment for the National Trust. Many country houses that were impacted by the war are deciding to focus on it as a topic. So, if you go to Dun & Massey, it's all about the war at the moment. And I really wanted to know how Ickworth fared. Were we stereotypical in being impacted?
So there's a memorial in the local church, but is there anything in Ickworth from the First World War?
Yeah, so I think through this project, we found a few really key objects. We didn't know, actually, when we first set out on this. We'll probably talk about it more later, but just behind me, there are a few of the objects that, through lots of investigation, Peter and the team found. And they brought out some really personal stories, not only about the family, but those who were on the estate as well. I think that's how we came at it. We already had a core research team here, some really lovely characters, strong characters in researching. And what we found, though, is because we were covering quite broad topics, we wanted to have, I suppose, more hands, more helpers who could go and beaver away in the books. So we set up kind of subgroups. Mm-hmm. So each core leader would take on a little group. The core would come in to us each month and we'd kind of hear what was going on and kind of guide the groups. And that's kind of how we've progressed it, really.
So Peter, you were asked to look after this particular strand. How did you go about it? What was your methodology for the research?
Right. Well, to begin with, of course, if we used the title Great War, I think that's probably the one that we've all settled upon. It's a vast, vast subject. And we've got to start from the viewpoint of Ickworth. Well, what do we mean by that? We had to define what our exam question was, as it were. And we wanted to get the context and then drill down into the individual stories and how it affected Ickworth. But what do you mean by Ickworth? So we decided upon the community, the people. It's not about a house. It's not about some fields or acres. It's about the people, basically, and how they all interact with each other. So we looked at the community. We decided on a community of Ickworth, the Ickworth estate, and Horringer, which is basically on the gates to it. And most people who lived in Horringer actually rented property from the Harveys. And this total sort of interwoven of social and economic. So it made sense to look at that. And that way we could look at the First World War through, if you like, the prism of the Ickworth estate and sort of get context. And then, as I say, be able to sort of hold up the individual stories against that broader context. Sounded great. A lot harder to do in practice, though. Because one of the issues you've got, of course, is you'll think, well, it's just the beginning of the 20th century. There are records. Well, there are some records. They're not evenly distributed across all the subjects, but there are some. But equally, you're still within living memory, so there's some things that are still closed to you for all sorts of personal reasons. So we had to deal with we had to be a bit diplomatic in the way we approached some things. But we had a range of resources to go from, not least of which was the team itself, which are all from volunteers here at Ickworth. You've got the vast internet and all the websites on that, which are really good, but there's also pitfalls there. A lot of what's on the internet isn't necessarily accurate, but it's a great way to start and it's a good signpost. You've got the local records office, you've got the National Archives, you've got, once you get into it, there's lots of records. We've also got a very good library of oral interviews here. Which another resource which we've used to sort of get some of the stories and some leading on that. So we settled down and to start to look at what it was that affected the community. And I think overall, if you look at the broader spectre, it challenged a lot of the preconceptions, certainly that I had, of the Great War.
Mm. Yeah, the general idea is that the World War I, First Great War, is a watershed. Everything changes afterwards. Nobody's the same. And the big estates like this were ruined. And is that what you found out about Ickworth, or is that not what you found out?
No. I think we had a look at the books of account, which are still in the record office, for the period just before the First World War up to it. And whilst I'm not an accountant, you can look at the figures and what have you, and you can look at the cash books and look at the records they kept of the animals and what have you. There's no major trauma throughout the First World War, the Great War, recorded in the books. They started off with X number of livestock. They ended with pretty much the same. There was no drafting of horses from here. They didn't lose any horses to the military. If you look at the income from rents stayed pretty much the same throughout the war. And shooting rights and all of that. It didn't seem to affect the running of it. But you could see, from starting before the First World War, that cash injections were being made by the Marchioness and by the Marquess into the estate. Mm. And that started before and it carried on afterwards. And I think it was a longer-term decline that was in place. And I don't know that the First World War exacerbated. It may have done, because after the First World War, of course, you had increased taxes on death duties and what have you. So it may have accelerated what was already a decline.
Lots of big estates got taken over, didn't they, by the military? There's no evidence, I think, that Ickworth was ever taken over by the military. Why was that?
Well, that's very interesting. There were attempts. Certainly, the Marquess allowed the military to use the Acquirth estate for training purposes, and there's evidence of quite a few regiments training on here. And there's also evidence of a bit of friction between the Marquess and the military authorities, because soldiers would be caught poaching and abusing the properties and what have you. So there is a lot of interesting letters exchanged between the estate office in Bury and the military. And there was also one request from the commander of the First Army to requisition Ickworth, which was rebuffed by the Marquess. So whilst it wasn't taken over by the military, certainly there was a couple of firing ranges also around the estate, but it wasn't taken over.
I find that really interesting, because it's when we think from a national trust point of view, most country houses now are telling that story of being taken over and the military, and that makes us very different compared to others.
I mean, how did the Marquess manage to keep the army's hands off his property?
Well, I think if you look at the history of the Harvey family, they are great exponents of what we today call soft power. They had huge influence even then. And they had it handed down through generations. They were always close to where the real power was. And by subtle sort of favours to monarchs and what have you, or where the power was, they kind of got their way. And they also had a status then, and they did have high status.
There were several committees, weren't they, locally in the Suffolk?
That if you look at, we looked at the Harveys themselves here, Ickworth didn't go into active service, but the Marquess was pretty influential. He was on a series of committees. For instance, he was on the Military Tribunal Committee here, which looked at all the people who were conscripted, and they could ask to be exempted or deferred or what have you. And also they dealt with people like conscientious objectors. So he was actually the chair of that. He was also on the War Agricultural Committee for West Suffolk, which, as the war progressed, as you know, food became scarce, rationing came in right at the end. There wasn't enough wheat to go around. By 1917, the Germans started to exacerbate an already dangerous situation by sinking Allied ships. So this committee looked at improving production of food in England and Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland. And they could actually and did have the power to direct cattle farmers to turn their pastures over to arable farming. But that kind of didn't happen here, interestingly. But
and Theodora was on a similar one, wasn't she, for agriculture, the Women's was on Agricultural Committee?
She was, and she was also the acting president of the Red Cross Society for West Suffolk, and there's lots of evidence of her involvement in that. Yeah. So that the family here did actually get involved in a lot of civic things. They're also involved in looking after soldiers and sailors, benevolent thing around pensions.
Was there no pressure for this to become a hospital or anything like that?
Again, that... We've not found any evidence of pressure on them, but the Red Cross Society here, which the Marchioness was the president of, did set up the one at Amptill Hall, and they use that. But here, no.
It feels like they did just enough to keep kind of people at bay, almost. That they were doing just enough good work to kind of, you know, keep away those pressures that were coming into them.
So, Iris, if the war didn't have as much of an impact on the estate of Ickworth as we might have assumed, is it true that it didn't have much of an impact on the people of Ickworth as well?
No, I think it had a huge impact. And I think just looking at the memorial in Harringer Church of the men who died, lots of similar names, you know, lots of names from the same family. And we know from records in the record office in Bury, we've got a lovely record of Ickworth Parish, a handwritten record that someone recorded every name of every man from all the families in Harringer and Ickworth who joined, in some cases their age, what they did on the estates. We've got gardeners, we've got under gamekeepers, we've got people from the house. And there were, you know, for example, a family with perhaps had 9, 11 children, and they'd have 5 sons, and they'd all join up. You know, so it had a big effect. Not all of them died, of course. They came home, but they came home to a different world, and they might have come home and found that their own parents had died in the meantime. It wasn't just that the parents might have lost some sons from the family.
I mean, the fourth Marquess was a retired naval, actually he was a captain, Were any Harveys involved in the war? Were any of the immediate families involved?
They were. We've got a couple of people on the silhouettes behind us who we've got Henry Hall, who was a major. He was in his 40s, 50s at the time, and I think he was in the Suffolk Regiment doing a sort of, I suppose, a paper job. He didn't sort of go off and fight. And Eric Carvey, who we know a little about, again, I think he had a desk job. But the Marquess's own second cousin, who was more his age, Gerald, certainly went off and fought and actually died. And his family, he was a close, you know, fairly close connection, second cousin. So it was the Marquess's father and his own father that were cousins. They were devastated by his loss, and they put up a wonderful stained glass window for him in Tendring, which is where his father and mother were living at the time. So that must have been quite a blow for them. That was a blow that would have hit home to the Harveys, even though they were older themselves.
Of the various stories of the various families, which is the one that you felt most...
Well, I set off looking at several families, thinking, I don't know where this is going to go and how much we're going to find out. But actually, when you really get down to it, you can find out an enormous amount of information about these families. The Crack family was a large family, not unusual at the time, had 11 children. John Crack, the father, had been a gardener on the estate for many years. And they had five sons, and every one of them served in the war in a different way. The first son, actually the oldest son, had joined up as quite a young man long before the First World War, and he was in India. He didn't see any action, he didn't fight, but nonetheless he didn't come home because he died of a heart attack in India. So although he wasn't, you know, that was during the First World War.
So although we think of the First World War as being the trenches of Flanders, yeah, they're fighting all over the place.
Yes, they another one went off, another son from the family, Edgar, and he contracted malaria. He was out in the Balkans. We don't sort of think about the illnesses that they got. You know, they didn't just get blown up and shot. He had malaria, he was very sick, it kept recurring. And he must have been a very sick man. Nevertheless, he managed to get home and get married and settled in Sudbury. You know, he bought a market garden in Sudbury. You know, just little things like that, we can relate the fact that he did have a life. His brother Thomas was at Ypres in one of the battles of Ypres. And we've got from our war diaries that you can discover either by them or online, we know that he was sniped through the head. He was killed in an action early one morning. We've actually got a description from someone that was with him at the time, saying that we went over early in the morning and taken our objective, and then when Crack was sniped through the head, and he was quite dead, having been killed instantly, this poor chap. He was 23, he was a rather tall, slim, dark, very quiet man, and he looked more like a city man than a labourer. And he'd been a batman. So that was very, very sad. In fact, this family, because five of their sons, all their sons had gone to the war, the father, John Crack, received a letter from the keeper of the Privy Purse, which is basically... the guy that sort of did things for the king, saying, well done that you've sent all your sons to the war, and you know, what a noble effort for the empire, kind of, you know, words
very
of that
poignant,
effect.
Isn't it?
Very, very poignant. And we don't know what effect that would have had on the family after they realised that slowly they were losing their sons. In fact, out of the five, one died in India, and this poor chap was shot. Another one was shot very young, he was only 25, and only two of them came home. But when they got home, their mother, Caroline, had died. She died just after the first son died in India in 1917. So, it really started to make you think about these names. They're not names, they're actually people, and they lived and worked on the estate at some point.
Yeah. They're not just numbers anymore.
They're not just numbers. And yeah, there were several families with similar tales to tell. We had a family, two of the sons won the military medal. And it was awarded almost on the same day One was a posthumous medal because he was killed, but the other one actually got his medal and lived. And but the bravery of the families, you know, the sons.
Do we have any overall numbers of people from the estate who were involved, and how many of them came back? I mean, and how does that compare to the average for the country, as it were?
Well, I'm always sort of wary of figures, but we do have some, and one of the team, Patrick, did some really good work on this. But if you look at the national figures, approximately 6 million enlisted, and about 1 million were either killed or were missing, and a further 2 million wounded. If you take the population of the Ickworth Horringer we looked at, it was 850, and out of that, 188 men enlisted, and 39 were killed or missing. And that actually represents a slightly higher percentage than the national average. And if you drill down further, actually on the Ickworth estate, about 50 men who worked on the Ickworth estate went to war, and 7 of them were killed. That's about 14% of that, which is almost double the national average of the population. Now, you can read into all sorts of things why that was. There we are. It has an impact. But it's interesting. And going back to the Crack family, of course, the sister, Kate, was also a maid here, and she married the head gardener, William Rolls, who also went off to war. Mm. And he was not only was he a horticulturist, he wrote journals and books on horticulture, and he carried on doing that while he was in the trenches. He actually came back and picked up his career again in horticulture. So there's all these individual stories.
In fact, we found out that William and Edgar, who was part of the market garden, actually William was his best man when he got married, and William was also part of this market gardening enterprise. Mm. So they were obviously very close as brother-in-laws. So all these little snippets, you know, the human bits.
Do you think there was any resentment from the people, you know, the families that were on the estate, to the Marquis, who wasn't kind of opening his house for hospitals or...
There's no evidence of that, and all the things, not just in this but other streams, is that the Harveys were well regarded and the Marquis was well thought of. But we did try to have a look at sort of the broader cross-section of society. There was another family on the estate, although they didn't work on the estate, they lived on the estate, was the Bevans. And very much the father was a banker in Bury, and middle class, and all the sons, again, I think it was 5, were officers, some in the Navy, some in the Army, and one of those lost his life as well. But it's interesting, you look at that's 1 out of 4 officers. But if you take away the naval ones, then it's a higher percentage of officers that were killed, which is what we're told. There's no evidence. And in fact, towards at the end of the war, a year after 1919, the Marquis held a celebratory dinner for all those who had fought in the war on the estate. And there's about 60-odd names. We've got the list of names, actually, in our little pamphlet that we've put together. And they're all there, and some of the names that we researched are there coming back, and they held this dinner to say thank you. It was on a day when there was a overall celebratory occasion held right across the estate.
We've talked a lot about the men. Is there any evidence, Iris, of what happened to the women on the estate?
We haven't got a lot at this point in time. We're going to look more into this because we think there must be stories. Of course, it's a lot harder to find out about the women because them not joining the military, we haven't got, you know, medal cards, and we haven't got sort of military records. But we'll keep digging. We'll dig deep, see what we can find.
It'd be interesting to see how that connects up with the Red Cross and the agricultural, Women's Agricultural Committee, because Theodora was kind of head of that, wasn't she? And she was encouraging women to get onto the lands. And
she did. In fact, she stood up in 1916 as the... on the committee, the War Agricultural Committee, and she said then, she made a public speech, and she said 5,000 women had signed up to the Land Army in West Suffolk. Mm. So it's a lot of them.
Yeah.
And you know, we're really keen to sort of get more information out, as we are the VADs, the Voluntary Aid Detachments. We have sent an inquiry off to the Red Cross about that, and we're still waiting on that. So we're hopeful we can actually fill in that gap, but it is an enormous gap at the moment.
It's interesting, there's Theodora as a motivator in society, because 5,000 people, that's a huge,
in Suffolk,
that's a huge number to get kind of rallied up and going.
So if we've now looked at the impact on the estate, which is perhaps not as extreme as we would have imagined it to be, and we've looked at it on the terms of the people, can we now start looking at some of the objects you found? Are there any stories involved with the objects?
Can I bring some over?
Yes.
Yeah. I may have trouble with my sound pack. Excuse my putting my gloves on. So, I don't know if anyone wants to actually kind of explain what some of these things are.
The one that's obvious to see is the silhouette.
I mean, the silhouette's here.
Iris, can you talk us through the silhouette?
Well, we've got all these people on here are members of the Harvey family, and we discovered in our team that actually they were made by quite a famous guy called Handrup, who was a famous silhouette maker of his day. And
in London.
But they were. It was a result of a bank holiday. Was it an August bank holiday?
It was a fate.
And the idea
of these was quite well-to-do people, or you know, the connected, would have their silhouettes done, and any money from that would go to they called it the waifs and strays, basically the society. So it's kind of just another way of supposedly them helping the local community.
So this happened in the war, but it's not particularly about the war.
Not particularly, except we've got we've got Henry Hoare, the major who I mentioned earlier, and Eric Harvey. So and that, because they were part of the war, that's obviously quite nice to have a representation of the time.
Yeah. But we do, I think, have something that actually came from the war, don't we?
In fact, I'll bring them over so we can. On there. Peter, this is kind of your little baby. Yeah. Did you want to talk about this first? I can hold it up.
I was going to say, this is the one that fascinates me most because it's the most inconspicuous looking thing.
So you might have to come and have a look a bit closer later on.
And yet it has quite an involved story, doesn't it?
Yes, this was story around this started off with a hospital pass from Graham one monthly meeting when Graham said, no, we're doing the First World War research. Have you seen this? It's a little medallion. It's got an inscription on it, but it appears to be wrong. So I thought, oh, thanks. So I thought, I'll have a look at that. And many months later, we got to almost the bottom of this story. What it is, it's a very lightweight disc, and it says on it, part of Zeppelin L-21 destroyed at Cuffley, September 2nd, 1916. Well, maybe. I think we don't doubt the authenticity of it, but it's a long story behind it. Basically, on the 2nd and 3rd of September 1916, there was a massive air raid from Germany with about 16 airships that came over here and bombed, aiming for London, but like in those days, this is early technology then, random bombing of East Anglia and the home counties. And up to that point, air defences in this country were awful, and not a single Zeppelin or airship or aircraft indeed had been downed, and there was a lot of mounting anger about this. Anyway, on this particular night, this particular airship was actually successfully shot down by a Lieutenant William Leif Robinson, who within days was awarded the Victoria Cross. And this was a national event. This was the first one to be shot down, and he was a hero, a public hero. And you start to look at the press at the time, and it's full of it, and it starts to come out about this Zeppelin L-21. The problem is, it wasn't a Zeppelin, it wasn't L-21. And you're thinking, well, why? And I even looked at going into his private papers, and he's written a letter the following month to his parents describing the action, how he did this, and it was not easy. And he describes it as, refers to it as L-21. And you're thinking, well, what's going on here? Because it wasn't, it was a what's known as a Schutz Lanz, which is a different type. It's an airship, but it wasn't a Zeppelin. And it wasn't L-21, it was SL-11. So why was this? So I had a look at this, and the authorities knew exactly the identity of this airship. You go to the National Archives and you get out all the old intelligence files on it, there it is, plain as you can see, it's referred to as SL-11. They knew that within a day. It was analysed, the wreckage was gone over, it was taken away, analysed both by the Royal Naval Air Service in Yorkshire and by the Royal, what's now the Royal Aircraft Establishment in Farnborough, and both, in their reports, you can see within days, referring to it correctly as a Schutz Lanz, and it was an SL-11. We have to remember at this time, though, that the government controlled strictly all information about this sort of event, and also there was a lot of anger in the press about Zeppelin baby killers, as they were called. Although the actual number of deaths caused by these things throughout the war was minimal, it was 1,414, there's a figure for you, and about just under 3,000 injured. In fact, more people were killed on a single night in the Second World War Blitz than in the entire First World War. But it had a disproportionate effect. People got very angry about this because for the first time, England was no longer an island and they were being bombed from the air. So there may have been a bit of spin put to this, that this was put out as a Zeppelin, an L-21, and there was a Zeppelin numbered L-21, and it was on that raid, but this wasn't the one. So we don't know. Interestingly, though, when this was shot down at Cuffley, we get round to the medal again, the wreckage was there, and very quickly some enterprising railway companies put on excursion trains from King's Cross, and over 10,000 members of the public turned up to Cuffley, which is just by Potter's Bar, to see this site, and guess what?
Tourist attraction.
They plundered it as well. As a consequence of this, the Defence of the Realm Act was actually altered to make it a criminal offence to take in bits and pieces away. And they also, there was a Home Office circular that went out, which again we've had a copy of, telling the chief constables to make sure when these things come down that the site is secured and what have you. But you could say, well, why? What was going on here? Why would they say that? Yes, you can take the engines away and the metal away and you can do some technical analysis of it. But there's another thing going on here as well, which we discovered. And that was that up until the beginning of 1916, the Royal Navy were reading the German naval codes, but the Germans changed their codes at the beginning of 1916. So they were desperate to get their hands on another code book. And guess what? The Zeppelins carried code books. So you can put two and two together. They were desperate that when these things were shot down, that they could recover a code book. And in fact, later in September, they did recover a code book from another Zeppelin that was shot down. But why you have these souvenirs was the wreckage was actually put on display and it was joined by other wreckage because they shot down some more later that month and they were put on public display. And then they gave the wreckage to the Red Cross and one or two other organisations to make souvenirs out of so they could sell them and make money for the Red Cross for looking after the wounded.
So this is not, the Harvest Nickworth isn't involved in that. Somebody bought themselves a souvenir.
It's very likely, and given that the Marchioness's connection with the Red Cross, that said, I mean, you can go on eBay, you can still buy them on eBay today. You look for these Zeppelin relics and you'll see, and there's usually little bits of wire on a card and it says, and usually it's wrong because it'll say L21, which is out there in the public domain is what it was. And sometimes it says Cuffley, Essex, and Cuffley's in Hertfordshire. But you've got all these things. And the Red Cross themselves are quite helpful. They gave it and they said, actually, although they were given a lot of the metal, and they commissioned about seven different firms to make souvenirs, there were other souvenir manufacturers who made them for themselves at profit. Now, I've not seen anywhere another disc like that. I've seen lots of other souvenirs and actually bits of wreckage and all that, but not an actual disc. And if you pick it up, it's really light. I don't doubt that it is from a Zeppelin or a Schutzlands, an airship, and probably is from the L-200, because the fact that it's misdescribed fits in with what the public knew at that time, so it probably is correct.
So if that's nothing to do with the Harvest, this other thing you've got. So yeah. That is, so we think that's to do with
we
the Harvest.
I think so. So I've got here a little box, gold box. So I think, Iris, you did quite a lot of investigation on this.
Yeah, I tried to find out about the content. Now, these boxes were given by Princess Mary, and there's a photo of Princess Mary in all these boxes, and they were given to every serving man in Christmas 1914. And they had cigarettes, of which we've got a packet, and we've got Princess Mary. And they have chocolate sometimes in them. A lot of them have survived. Again, it's something that you can find. But obviously this was kept for a reason. And we think, we're not 100% sure, but we think it was kept by possibly Lady Marjorie Harvey, who became Lady Marjorie Erskine. Mm-hmm. Because inside the box as well was a railway leave ticket. And these were issued to everybody that was travelling from France to get home. To even to their destination. And
this is a first-class one, isn't it?
It's a first-class one. So we knew already it belonged to an officer. It obviously wasn't, a private, a regular soldier. And the only little clue we got was that it was from France to Alloa. And Alloa's in Scotland. And so we got two clues. We've got it's an officer and they're in Alloa and immediately thinking about the family, what do we know? We've got a Scottish name, Erskine. Well, in fact, we've got two, and we've got McCrae as well. But by lots of digging and delving, I managed to find out that the Erskines, who are basically relatives, they're the Earls of Mar, their family, their home was actually Alloa House, Alloa Tower, as it is now. I think a lot of the house is fallen down, but Alloa Tower is still there. Got a feeling it might be National Trust or Scottish Trust. I think you can go in it. So we're almost certain that this belonged to Lord John Erskine, who at the time was the fiancé of Lady Marjorie Harvey. So I think we can almost say. The reason, we've got one more little corroboration to this, that we've got his medal record card. Now, he joined, he was in the Argyll and Southern Highlanders during the war, and he got transferred to, I think, at least one other regiment. Obviously, he was an officer. There's quite a bit of detail on his medal card that we've got. And at the bottom of this card, it's got home address, and it says Alloa Tower, Alloa, Stirlingshire, Scotland.
So if you had to summarise what you got from the big picture of this research, Peter, what would the main findings you would bring out?
I thought that it was an interesting window. If you take a small community like that and focus on it, and then look at the Great War through that prism, you got, I think, perhaps a more realistic view of that period of history, because you're relating it to real people and looking at what actually happened. And it did challenge some preconceptions. We go back to the bit about the Marquess being on board the military tribunals. Britain was the only belligerent nation to actually have any system in place to deal with conscientious objectors or people who wanted to avoid conscription or avoid or be exempted for all sorts of general reasons. And you look at the figures of that. In the period first of 1916, when conscription came in, 700,000 men applied for exemption or to be delayed, and most of them were granted it. You then look at the figures, there was about 16,000 conscientious objectors, so it's really minute. And only of those, most of those took other service, ambulances and what have you. There's only about 1,300 who actually were called absolutists, who refused to do anything. And they had a pretty bad time, to be fair. And some of them were sent to the front anyway and threatened with being shot. But most of them were imprisoned, and about 70 of them died in poor condition. But overall, the numbers don't bear the sort of what we saw, perhaps what I'd read in previous years, that it was, it was awful, and it was massive. It wasn't. In that same period, 700,000 enlisted, as opposed to, so that was kind of interesting to look at those figures.
That some people were refused, they weren't allowed to join up, were they?
So we have a story of, Charles Leach, don't we, the postmaster.
Yeah, I think you did a bit more on that.
Yeah,
Peter.
Basically, he's actually the father of Zoe Ward, who wrote the book Courtesy to Lady. But he tried on two occasions to enlist, the first time because he didn't meet the medical criteria. And the second time, he said, well, you're the postmaster, you can't. But in the end, he insisted.
Because deliver the post.
And the other thing, because there was a sad thing doing that, was also delivering the telegrams. But in the end, he got his way and he did enlist. And he fought, and he actually came back in 1919, but he did come back.
So we were more sympathetic than possibly history has.
We seem to be more. I hesitate to use the word liberal in the period of the Great War, but certainly we were more democratic, if you like, but certainly more awake to what the needs of the people
And do
were.
We have any evidence of whether the fourth Marquess, in his role on this panel, whether he was as liberal or less liberal? Or
sadly, we don't, because after the end of the First World War, there was an order from central government that all records of military tribunals would be destroyed, and they saved two, one in a tribunal in Scotland and one, I think, Middlesex, to serve sort of for general sort of history purposes. But all the rest were destroyed because of the sensitivity of nature of what was in those records, which in itself tells you something, really. Mm. So it's quite interesting. And, of course, after the Great War, you've then got all these huge changes, the Representation of the People's Act, which trebles the electorate and brings in votes for women for the first time, albeit 30 years and over. You had legislation coming in for benefits. You had, during the war, people starting to get benefits for war widows and for separation allowances and all this sort of thing. So, and you start to look at that and see, so it challenged some of the preconceptions, the whole thing about lions and donkeys and oh, what a wonderful war, that you might have picked up as baggage. The detail's not quite that.
What are you planning to do next with all this information, Chloe? What schemes have you got?
I think there's a few things that I think we've achieved from this project. So I think now we have this really strong structure for researching at Ickworth. I think the way that we've set up this core team with these mini sort of sub-groups looking at themes has been really positive. I think it's definitely the way forward. And I think because when we started out as a kind of a research group, we agreed that any information that we pulled together and were giving out to volunteers, to visitors, staff, it should be accurate. It should be, I think, have some integrity to it. And I think now we've got Peter's wonderful and the team's wonderful document. It's kind of dissertation style, and actually we can use that to either look at the subject of the war as a whole or delve more deeply into some of those really poignant stories about the family or get those little details about objects. Because actually, we didn't really know these objects were in the collection. They were sort of there amongst thousands of other objects, and just being able to pull them out and highlight those stories that are connected to them has been...
Is it possible
amazing.
For them to be on display? Is that
Yeah, so
doable?
I think what we want to do for next year, because we're still in kind of this period of remembrance, is have some sort of exhibition that uses lots of this information that you pulled together, shows some of the objects that we've got in the collection, connects to the family and those who were kind of working, living here, but also brings in the community now. Because I'm sure out there in Horringer and wider, there are lots of people who've got things, you know, grandfathers, fathers who were dealing with either World War One or World War Two, and I think trying to get some of their thoughts would be really useful as well.
Thank you. I'm sure there are questions from the audience when my voice comes back. But let's start off with Colin, who I know has got something he wants to ask.
I'd like to go back to the numbers involved, please. Could we have the figures for the proportion of those who were called up or volunteered in the early part of the century, and how many actually came back again?
Right, well, the first part is dead easy. No, because we don't know. that is a proportion, as I understand it, between those that volunteered and those who were conscripted. We haven't got that detail. I guess we could. It's a level of detail we didn't get. As regards to those that came back, well, I'll go back to, I think the figures here were 188 enlisted, 39 were killed, so I'm assuming that 140 came back, or thereabouts. Of course, what we don't know, and there's another area we didn't pursue, of course, is the whole thing about shell shock. We'd like to have done that, and something might pick up, but interestingly, that was quite a considerable problem, to the extent that the army set up 6 hospitals in the UK to deal with what they call these mental problems at the end of the war for officers, and 13 hospitals for the other ranks. So post-traumatic stress disorder, although it wasn't called that then, was certainly there, and it certainly affected a lot of people. And that's something, again, we haven't got. I don't think we picked up any of the interviews either. But I don't doubt that in that 140-odd people that came back, some, if not all, will be affected in some way and all that. It would be nice to get into it. But again, we're back to this thing about early 20th century, it's personal records, what access do we have to them? A lot of this you can't get to unless you're actually a member of the family. But it is an area that might be worth pursuing.
We did have one poor chap, because it wasn't just shell shock. We did have one poor chap that we found that he was in his 30s when he went, and he'd been in the stables. So I guess he'd always been working in an environment with lots of dust and things in the hay. And his lungs were very bad. And he sort of just came back and died of pneumonia, really, you know, having been out in poor conditions in the trenches. And so he came back, but to no avail. And there'd been, as Peter said, there'd been shell shock a lot. There'd been, you know, these various, you know, maybe more malaria cases that didn't make it. I think we're probably, as we uncover more personal stories, we might be able to discover and perhaps do a little section on that.
Mm. Are there any other questions? If not, I know Colin's got another one.
Not really, you've answered
them. All right. Fran.
The number of people that went from Ickworth was not insignificant, mm-hmm. But you say that the sort of the income didn't suffer from the land. Is there any evidence of people coming to fill those jobs during the war, whether prisoners of war or people from the Women's Land Army or anything like that?
Right. First of all, a lot of the income is derived from rent. Mm. They would rent out. So the loss of labour wouldn't directly impact, other than gardeners and perhaps the woodsmen and what have you, immediately. But it would affect, of course, the income for the farms for which they were getting rent from. But there doesn't appear to be anything that the rent level stayed the same. Because what that doesn't tell you is what was the impact on the families who ran the farms. There is a little bit of anecdotal evidence about some of the lawns being turned over to arable growing crops and what have you. And there's also, again, some anecdotal evidence about the women mucking in and doing some of the work on the estate because the men had gone off to war. But I've got no hard and fast figures. And the problem, of course, with that is a bit of what Iris was saying, that there's no standardised record of that happening. It kind of just happened because the community did that. You know, they all mucked in. They're all one community, which is, again, back to the thing, what we're looking at, how did it affect it and what have you. We could look at other things. We could look at some of the levels of income. But again, it's that there will be records about separation allowances and pensions and widows' pensions and all that. They're interesting. But again, whilst they wouldn't have made anybody rich, interestingly, they weren't bad. The average pension for a widow who lost her husband in fighting was about half of what an agricultural labourer would earn. So it was set at a reasonable level, and then the children's allowance was separate from that, and they would continue to receive something until they were 16. So it kind of shows a benevolence, if you like, that was there.
So you're implying that possibly in the farms, the women were taking up the slack of the men who went away, is that? Mm.
Yes, and also you've got, as I said earlier, that there was at least 5,000 women in the land army who were brought in. Mm. And there were various committees on which the Harveys sat to try and deal with all these things, not least of which was the shortage of food and what have you. In fact, there's one of the little anecdote we found, and that was that talk about what's current. In 1916, there was a butcher in Ipswich who was fined £10, about £600 now, for selling, would you believe, horse meat as beef. Nothing new, is it?
And do we have any other questions? Well, thank you very much. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope to see you again.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Thank you.